And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is back here with me again. Hi, Lee. What's up?
Hey, Michelle. Well, this week we began our look at the challenges of elder care. In our Tuesday parenting segment, we discussed juggling the needs of children and a spouse while caring for an elderly parent. And after that, we heard from lots of listeners, including Fred, who told us about his experience caring for his older relatives.
I don't have siblings. I don't have other relatives to rely on to take care of my elders. And until recently, I had three very old people. Now I have two. And they're always turning to me. And for many years, I have to put aside my love life, my work life, my finances can go into disarray because people have needs. And I respect them. They took care of me when I was a baby. I don't resent this work, but it's a real-life challenge.
Fred, let me say, you hang in there. We hear you. We appreciate you. And I want to thank all who wrote in with stories and suggestions about how to cover this obviously very important and emotional issue. So thank you for that. Yep. Lee, this week we also gave listeners a peek into Baltimore nightlife as we explored the subculture of house music. Our producers paid a visit to Club Paradox in the Charm City.
My name is Sonia Hillier. I've been coming for how many years? It's been at least probably 14 years, I'll say. And I just love house music.
And now, as a compliment to that piece, Tell Me More contributor Lester Spence posted a blog on our website about his diehard love for house music. He wrote about how it got him through some difficult times, and that inspired readers to share their own stories. Here's a post from blogger Nancy. She writes, I was exposed to house by DJ Marcus Wyatt in L.A. at an after-hours called Does Your Mama Know? And she sure as hell didn't. House music spoke to the deepest pits of my soul. Having been fortunate enough to never get involved in drugs, I'm amazed that I can still stay up till 4 a.m. dancing. You know that's right.
That's crucial right there. All right. Thanks, Nancy.
Okay, Lee, any updates?
Yes, two things. Well, back in 2007, we covered an immigration rally in Los Angeles that turned violent after police ordered crowds to disperse. And right after the dust settled, we spoke to journalist Patricia Nazario. She was there on the scene covering the event for the local NPR member station KPCC. Michelle, she told us how she was beaten repeatedly with a baton by members of the LAPD. Well, last Friday, a jury awarded Nazario $40,000 as part of almost $2 million in settlements to resolve lawsuits filed by others who were injured at the rally. And another thing we reported on this program was the controversy surrounding world track star Caster Semenya of South Africa. Now, there were questions about the athlete's incredible speed and deep voice that led to a highly publicized investigation about her gender. And the ongoing debate and ambiguous results from gender testing sidelined her career, Michelle, for nearly a year. But this week, Semenya was cleared by the International Association of Athletics Federations to compete as a woman.
Wow. It's a very interesting story. Thank you, Lee.
Thank you, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. You can also log on to our website. Go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.
For centuries, people had little idea what went on in their leaders' private conversations. But with the rise of recording equipment, we've gotten a few more insights. Richard Nixon's Watergate tapes, for example, revealed a side of him that hadn't been widely seen. He liked to swear.
All right, you get a hold of Weinberger and say, I want the funds and I want him to know it now. Get it done.
Right. Okay. These days, the use of profanity may be more than just a slip of the tongue. Here's Yahoo CEO Carol Bartz responding to a question from an interviewer who insinuated her company wasn't moving fast enough on new technology.
You're just getting
I don't want to hear any crap about something magical that the fine people of Yahoo are supposed to do in this short time. So f*** off.
And last month, President Obama used some strong language about the people cleaning up the BP oil spill.
We talked to these folks because they potentially had the best answers, so I know who's to kick.
As it turns out, our leaders sometimes swear strategically. And here to talk about when it works and when it doesn't is Robert Sutton. He's an organizational psychologist who teaches at Stanford University. Robert Sutton, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Lynn.
And I should mention that you are also the author of a book, Unfortunately, We Can't mention the title of that book on the air.
It's the no jerk rule, but it really isn't jerk. It's a letter that starts with an A and rhymes with castle.
Let me ask you how you know when a leader is intentionally deciding to swear or use profanity and when it's a slip.
Well, I think that the main sign we can tell is when it's a backstage versus a front stage, especially when some of the backstage kind of leaks out. There was one point when President Bush sort of whispered to Cheney that there was a reporter in the audience who was a jerk.
Adam Clymer, major league
Oh, yeah, yeah, time.
But the example I think you had of Carol Bartz and also President Obama, I think they were using it quite strategically. And I even suspect in the case of Obama, it was in a script or something they had discussed, because swear words, taboo words, pack an emotional wallop that the ordinary words, the replacements, simply cannot.
Well, what might a person be trying to accomplish by using a word like that that packs a wallop?
Well, sometimes it's kind of a bonding effect. I mean, if you listen to the backstage tapes with both Lyndon Johnson and with President Nixon, that was just the way those guys talked to one another. So it's just part of being the group. Another effect is that when you want to shock people and especially create emotional arousal, Carol Bartz, I think that's a lot of what she's doing strategically. And then the last thing is authenticity. That's who Carol is, and it comes across very straightforward. And in fact, she's got a very tough turnaround job at Yahoo. And to me, that shows that she's a tough boss and she means it.
And let's talk about the fact that Carol Bartz is a woman. And would a woman particularly decide to use that kind of language as a way to prove herself to the guys?
In the case of somebody like Carol Bartz, I hate to bring up the notion of personality, but I believe Carol has always been that way. Let's just say that Michelle Obama started talking like that. I think we would all just be horrified and shocked. But Carol Bartz, it's sort of like a comedian talking that way.
I guess the quote that kind of sums it up, I think it comes from General Patton, "When I want it to stick, I give it to them loud and dirty."
And I think that's very consistent with the notion that words are just tools in a toolbox. And sometimes when you really need that wallop, you want to get out the word. But then there's other times when you don't want to give it to them loud and dirty because you embarrass them. You get them all cranked up and you've kind of got a mess on your hands. So this stuff is very related to the context and what you're trying to accomplish. And that can be for good or it can be for evil.
Robert Sutton is a professor in Stanford's Management, Science, and Engineering Department. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Today is the 50th anniversary of the publication of To Kill a Mockingbird. Author Harper Lee has always said the book is fiction, but that won't stop thousands from visiting her hometown of Monroeville, Alabama. Anna Boyko-Wyrock reports from the real town that inspired one of the most influential pieces of American literature.
All around downtown, there are glimpses of how Monroeville might have looked in the 1930s when Harper Lee grew up.
Okay, we're going to go right over here.
Sandy Smith heads the Monroeville Chamber of Commerce and gives a walking tour every Saturday morning during the spring.
The one where it says Johnson Jewelers, that was not here. There was another building on that piece of property.
There's a mighty courthouse in the middle of the town square, now a To Kill a Mockingbird museum. Today, a lot's changed in Monroeville. Lee's childhood home has been razed. Down the road, there's a Walmart and McDonald's. But there are also a lot of well-preserved brick buildings from the 20s. One thing sets this town of 6,000 people apart from others. Literary geekiness. To Kill a Mockingbird illusions are everywhere. Like a huge bird mural downtown.
That is what a mockingbird looks like.
Smith says 25,000 visitors come here every year. She expects to get 20% more this year. In fact, the town is holding a series of mockingbird-related events, some going for as much as $75 a ticket. Harper Lee doesn't give interviews anymore. She said that the book and its setting are fictional. But looking at Lee's childhood, there are a lot of parallels. Lee and her main character, Scout, both had fathers who were lawyers, and they both had a mysterious neighbor feared by local kids. Monroeville isn't the town in the book, but it's as close as visitors will ever get. In the Courthouse Museum, Japanese native Yoshimi Yoshifuji drove here for the day because she says she was curious after she saw the movie adaptation of the book.
My first impression was the South really was a challenged place. That was my impression. So after watching that, I think everyone wonders what it's like now.
Yoshi Fuji recently moved to Alabama from Japan and picked up a copy of the book when she was in town. Mockingbird souvenirs make hot items, and local businesses are looking to cash in on demand.
This is one of my courthouse plates, done in gold with gold and black accents.
Faye Dewitt runs the Purple Papaya, a small art store across from the Courthouse Museum.
I've got round plates and the square plates, Mockingbird margarita glasses.
Did you come up with that?
There was a drink called the Mockingbird margarita, so I just came up with my own glass.
A few blocks away from the art studio, the Mockingbird Grill is busy. A framed picture from the movie and an autographed copy of the novel sit at the entrance. Kenya Perez, a waitress at the cafe, says she sees the author around town all the time.
She would come in, but she don't like to be noticed, right? Her and her sister used to go down to the lake to feed the ducks, and I would take my baby, and they would have some corn that they would give to the ducks, and one day she gave my baby some, and they fed the ducks.
Further back in the restaurant, local teacher Chester Moore just finished lunch. A native of Alabama, Moore remembers reading the book for the first time, especially the mistrial of Tom Robinson, a black man.
I thought, wow, well, I'm so glad that some things have changed. I'm so glad that this story was written, and I'm so glad that it depicts some of the cultural things that were happening.
Today, the book has taken on new importance for the region, which has 20% unemployment. Sandy Smith at the Chamber of Commerce says attention from Harper Lee's story has given the town new purpose.
Monroeville, since the 1930s, has been a manufacturing hub, and we have had a lot of plants idled in the last couple of years because of the recession. And what this has given us is a way to at least hang on to something and somewhat reinvent ourselves off of it.
Peering down from the bookshelf behind Smith are two small statues of gray mockingbirds. For NPR News, I'm Anna Boyko-Wyrock.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Atticus Finch, the hero of To Kill a Mockingbird and its most famous character, has inspired many fans of the novel, including Weekend Edition essayist Diane Roberts.
My heroes have always been lawyers. John Adams, who defended the Boston Massacre Redcoats, Sarah Weddington, who argued the Jane Roe case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, Thurgood Marshall of Brown versus the Board of Education fame, and Atticus Finch, of course. He's one of the most important lawyers of the last 50 years, even if he is only a character in a novel. Now, Harper Lee didn't invent the type. Earl Stanley Gardner's Perry Mason was wowing juries with his razor-like brain about 30 years before To Kill a Mockingbird was published. William Faulkner's Gavin Stevens, the premier legal theorist of Yoknapatawpha County, Mississippi, also predates Atticus. But Scout Finch's daddy is an aristocrat, a great orator, a barrister saint. The Alabama State Bar even erected a monument to him in Monroeville, Harper Lee's hometown. Gregory Peck, linen-suited, super-handsome, uber-charming Gregory Peck, played him in the movie. No lawyer ever had better. It doesn't matter that he's not a real person. Atticus Finch influenced the intrepid, if more flawed, protagonists in the novels of John Grisham and Scott Turow. Generations of lawyers cite him as their reason for taking up the profession. Civil rights lawyer Morris Dee said he was inspired by Atticus Finch's brave defense of Tom Robinson, the black man falsely accused of raping a white woman. And I suspect Atticus Finch taught that eloquent Harvard-trained lawyer currently occupying the Oval Office something about empathy. Like when he says, "You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb into his skin and walk around in it." Much as I admire Atticus Finch, however, there are limits to his virtue. He's a good progressive on race, but when it comes to the pitiful Mayella Ewing, Tom Robinson's alleged victim, he treats her like poor white trash, the lowest of the low. And remember, Atticus loses Tom's case. Hardly surprising, I guess, with an all-white jury in the Jim Crow South. Noblesse oblige has been served, but Tom is shot and killed. and it's hard to tell if anything in Macomb, Alabama, has really changed. But Atticus is still my hero, if only because he does that hardest thing, defying his society, risking his reputation, all in the name of justice.
Diane Roberts teaches English at Florida State University in Tallahassee. This is NPR News.